Hello there. Today is Thursday, March 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump orders emergency grounding of the Boeing 737 MAX 8 and MAX 9 planes.
They are working very, very hard right now, and hopefully they'll very quickly come up with the answer. But until they do, the planes are grounded.
Trump's former campaign manager is handed 16 new indictments right after being sentenced on felony charges. Also ahead, a legendary female U.S. singer is about to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, President Trump announced Wednesday that the U.S. is also grounding the model of the American-made jetliner that crashed, making it the last high-profile country to pull the aircraft out of service. VOA White House reporter Patsy Wittakuswara reports.
The 737 MAX 8, Boeing's best-selling jet, will no longer fly the U.S. skies after President Trump declared an emergency order to ground it.
I didn't want to take any chances. We didn't have to make this decision today. We could have delayed it. We maybe didn't have to make it at all, but I felt it was important, both psychologically and a lot of other ways.
The day prior to Trump's announcement, Boeing CEO Dennis Muilenburg spoke with Trump by phone and reassured him the aircraft is safe. As a key military contractor, Boeing is a major lobbying force in Washington. The company donated $1 million to the presidential inaugural fund, and Trump has called the CEO a friend.
It's a very tough decision from the standpoint of a company like Boeing. It's a great, great company with a track record that is so phenomenal.
Through a statement, Boeing said they support the temporary grounding, but continues to have full confidence in the safety of the 737 MAX. Boeing shares have dropped 15% since Sunday's crash. The 737 MAX jets have crashed twice in 5 months, killing nearly 350 people, including those on board Indonesian Lion Air that crashed in October. A few hours before Trump's announcement, Canada joined dozens of countries in banning the aircraft.
The new information, and I hasten to say this is new information that we received and analyzed this morning, comes from validated satellite tracking data suggesting a possible, although unproven, similarity in the flight profile of the Lion Air aircraft.
Ethiopian authorities have recovered the aircraft's black boxes and plans to send them abroad for investigation. The flight data and cockpit voice recorders will provide important clues about the cause of the crash. Patsy Wittakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
Meanwhile, Acting Federal Aviation Administration Chief Daniel Elwell issued an emergency order, as we said, keeping the planes on the tarmac, and he cited new evidence that linked the Ethiopian jet's movements to those of an Indonesian Lion Air flight that plunged into the Java Sea in October, killing 189 people.
Both new pieces of information were added fidelity, missing pieces that we did not have prior to today, that aligned the track from Ethiopian Airlines track to Lion Air, closer than anything we had up until today.
Officials at Lion Air have said sensors on their plane produced erroneous information on its last four flights, triggering an automatic nose-down command that the pilots were unable to overcome on its final voyage. This air traveler, Priscilla Tremi, was relieved at the news that they're grounded, saying she didn't like the idea that she might be flying on a Boeing 737 MAX 8 as new questions emerged about its safety.
A little uneasy, actually. I fly Southwest a lot, and I thought that they should have done a better job of notifying people at least.
Meanwhile, in Ethiopia, an ancient land of pilgrimage, people are making a grim new journey of grief. One by one, friends and family of those killed on the Ethiopian Airlines flight site Wednesday with quiet offerings to the dead. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Eight people have been killed in a Nigerian building collapse, including trapped schoolchildren. The Senate is expected to disapprove President Trump's national emergency declaration. The Islamic State strikes back in its last stand at Baghouz, Syria. And Sudan's government is cracking down on protests and stirring concerns. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Trump's former campaign chair, Paul Manafort, was sentenced Wednesday to an additional 3.5 years in prison for conspiracy linked to his lobbying efforts in Ukraine for a pro-Russian political party, adding to the nearly 4-year term he was handed in a companion case last week. In failing health, the wheelchair-bound Manafort apologized to U.S. District Judge Amy Berman Jackson in a Washington courtroom, saying he was ashamed of his actions and pleaded for mercy. But Jackson told the 69-year-old Manafort she could not ignore his wrongdoing, telling him, "Saying I'm sorry I got caught is not an inspiring plea for leniency." Jackson had revoked Manafort's house arrest and jailed him last June after hearing allegations that he tampered with witnesses. She also specifically said the case he was tried for had nothing to do with Russian collusion, echoing an often stated line from President Trump. Manafort's attorney, Kevin Downey, used it anyway, despite what the judge said, as protesters shouted.
Judge Jackson conceded that there was absolutely no evidence of any Russian collusion in this case. So that makes two courts have ruled no evidence of any collusion with any Russian.
Well, shortly after his sentencing, a new grand jury accused Manafort of 16 counts of mortgage fraud to obtain bank loans. Joining us to sort it all out is criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. So, Jack, what was your reaction, first of all, to the 3.5-year sentence on Wednesday?
Well, I was expecting that he was going to receive 10 years in this case, and he didn't. And in fact, he really only received a couple of years more. Ultimately, in the end, he's going to serve about 7.5 minus the good time. And considering what it was he was convicted of in two different courtrooms, that's really quite a light sentence.
Once again, his attorney came out talking about no collusion, which seems to be a line directly from President Trump. But this judge actually made a point to say this trial and this sentencing and this conviction has nothing to do with colluding with Russia. Why do you think that Mr. Manafort's attorneys continue to toe that line?
Well, what is concerning about this is it almost feels like Mr. Manafort's attorneys are talking directly to the president, because it's consistent with what the president says over and over. And yet, if you look at what he was convicted of, what Mr. Manafort was convicted of, it was things like tax fraud. It was also things like fraud when it comes to various other things he was doing. But I think as importantly, it has to do with his failure to register as a representative of a foreign government. And that's a big deal. That's a crime in itself, and it's something that needs to be focused upon.
Why do you think she was as lenient as she was with Mr. Manafort?
You know, it's always a difficult question because you never know exactly what it was that was driving her in the first place. Part of it has to do with the fact that he does have no criminal record, and part of it has to do with the limited evidence that they did have and the charges that ultimately came. And I think based upon his cooperation, the idea that somehow this was the appropriate sentence. Of course, what that ignores is that he actually said he was going to cooperate with the FBI, the Justice Department, and in fact lied to justice. And so that the fact that he was ignoring that issue, that's one thing that I find difficult to understand. The other thing that he was actually found guilty of was trying to convince witnesses to lie, and I find that very difficult to understand why she would actually essentially downwardly depart.
The president spoke to reporters about it shortly after that, saying he feels very badly for Mr. Manafort. He has often talked about what's happening to Mr. Manafort being a disgrace, but he's been convicted of some very serious crimes, and why would the president continue to do this?
They're very serious, and what it almost feels like is the president is setting this up for a pardon. That really is my concern here. These were very serious. These were crimes, and he was convicted of these. Makes him a convicted criminal. To simply diminish that really says a lot of things that I think a lot of people are really, really concerned about right now.
But Mr. Manafort is one of the few people that has not, as the president calls it, flipped, or as he's called, his former attorney Michael Cohen a rat. Mr. Manafort, it would seem that all along he has been banking on a pardon and, you know, sort of working both sides of things while he said he was cooperating with prosecutors, also not really cooperating. So I would think that Mr. Trump, obviously, maybe that's why he's complimentary to this man.
If we look at where we are right now and what Mr. Manafort did, his claim that he was going to cooperate with justice and then ultimately does not do so seems to make him one of the good guys in the eyes of the president, which I find incredibly disconcerting because he is a convicted criminal who did things he's not supposed to do. There is no way to shine that up. There is no way to find that acceptable. And yet the president literally, in his own words, essentially says, this is a good guy, and apparently it was acceptable. So a lot of people are watching that issue right now.
And the other very interesting thing that happened was that literally, like right after the sentencing, the New York Attorney General's office indicted Manafort on 16 counts of mortgage fraud to obtain bank loans. And my understanding is these are charges that if convicted, he would not be eligible for a pardon.
Yeah, this is fascinating when you look at the Attorney General's decision within about an hour and a half of the sentence itself. 16 counts. And what makes this most important is that because they are state charges, the president doesn't have the ability to pardon in this case. The fact that it came so quickly thereafter really, I think, sends the point home very clearly that there are more things coming down the pike for Mr. Manafort and that he is nowhere near out of the woods at this point.
Do you think the timing was deliberate?
Yes. I think the timing was deliberate by the New York State Attorney General in bringing down the 16 counts right after the sentence. This is designed to make the point to Mr. Manafort and also to make the point to the entire nation that no matter what this president decides to do, justice will be done in some capacity at some point, and that New York intends to make sure that it happens.
All right. The criminal defense attorney, Jack Rice, thanks for your perspective. Prosecutors and tax documents say the mastermind of a wide-ranging college admissions scandal set up a charity that wove a deep web of deception and fraud to mask bribes. William Rick Singer is accused of funneling millions of dollars through the tax-exempt organization under the nose of U.S. officials. Singer has been charged with funneling money from wealthy parents through this foundation, then using it to bribe coaches and others to get their children into elite universities. College admissions counselor Rachel Beck says the scandal is really discouraging for hardworking students.
There's so many odds working against them to get in already, and then there's this really select pool of people who are really using this side door to get in. And we have no sense of how rampant this really is. This is just one subset that got caught. We don't know who else is doing that.
Yale graduate student Nicholas Snashaw Woodham says the people whose families cheated on their admissions shouldn't necessarily get kicked out, or should get kicked out.
This bribery scandal is really in the same vein as a lot of the other conversations that are happening around, like, access and privilege at elite universities and what it takes to get here.
And she says it's also unfair to students from lower-income families who are qualified for admission but don't get in.
To think that my spot could be taken by someone who didn't have to put in that effort it makes me angry.
Singer pleaded guilty to conspiracy and other charges in federal court Tuesday in Boston. Federal prosecutors charged 50 people, including coaches and dozens of parents, including several well-known TV stars and high-achieving figures in such fields as law, finance, and fashion. Authorities said parents hired Singer to bribe college coaches and administrators to boost their children's chances of admission by making them look like star athletes in sports they never played. He also hired people to take college entrance exams for students or paid off insiders to correct youngsters' answers. Some parents spent hundreds of thousands of dollars and one as much as $6.5 million, according to prosecutors.
This is Science in a Minute.
The sun occasionally blasts massive amounts of high-energy particles, causing solar storms here on Earth. Fortunately, since our planet is surrounded by a protective atmosphere and magnetic fields, most of the harm is minimized. But there have been solar storms so severe that radio and satellite communications and even power grids were interrupted. Scientists at Sweden's Lund University, studying ice cores drilled deep into Greenland ice, found evidence of three powerful solar storms in the distant past. Their latest findings suggest a powerful solar storm hit Earth in 660 BC. The researchers say that if that storm took place today, it could have had severe effects on our high-tech society. They suggest more should be done to understand the potential harm these storms could cause. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Arab citizens of Israel have been expressing anger over recent comments by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who said Israel is not a country of all its citizens. Some Israeli Arabs are calling for a boycott of Israel's election. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
The first shots of the battle played out on Instagram, with actress and model Rotem Sela posting, "When the hell will someone in the government convey to the public that Israel is a state of all its citizens?" Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu quickly responded, "Dear Rotem, an important correction. Israel is not a state of all its citizens. According to the nation-state law we passed, Israel is the nation-state of the Jewish people, and not anyone else." The exchange comes less than 2 months before the Israeli elections and infuriated Arab citizens of Israel, who make up 20% of Israeli voters. It comes after the Israeli Election Commission said that one Arab party, Balad, cannot run in the election because its members allegedly support terrorism, a charge they deny. At the same time, the commission approved an extremist Jewish party that calls for Arabs to leave Israel. Aida Tumi Suleiman, an Israeli Arab Knesset member, said the election is crucial for the future of democracy in Israel.
The next government will determine if this country is going a little bit to the situation of democracy, of human rights, of equality, or is it going to be clearly an apartheid regime with legal system that is supporting the practices of an apartheid regime.
She said her party is appealing to the Supreme Court against the decision to bar the Arab party Balad. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
Voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices
with me, Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. New Zealand is 3 years into what is arguably the world's most ambitious conservation program. The government has set a goal of eradicating all non-native predator pests by 2050 in order to protect the country's fragile indigenous wildlife. While poison will play a part in some areas, officials are hoping that technological advances will help. From Nelson, New Zealand, Phil Mercer reports.
The sound of success echoes through a large predator-free enclosure on New Zealand's South Island. It's been years since native birds sang in these parts because of a plague of possums, rats and stoats. These voracious pests were killed off by poison dropped from the sky. Dave Butler is the head of the Brook Waimarama Sanctuary near Nelson. He oversaw an aerial baiting program where poison was dropped from a helicopter, which is allowing native species to thrive here once again.
We saw the first sort of season after the pest removal, big increases in some of the common birds here, the tuis and the fantails and so on. So there's definitely an increase of song here.
It takes 7 hours to walk around the pest-free enclosure. It was completed in September 2016, and Butler says there are plans to expand the project.
We've got the opportunity of working back into the city from here, so 10 minutes drive away, and bringing these amazing birds back into people's gardens. And then this way, we've sort of got 100,000 hectares of native forest to start restoring and bringing that back. And that all ties into the very exciting, challenging vision the country has of predator-free 2050. So starting to remove, push back these predators from large areas is really the next step of that.
We share Aotearoa with some pretty special native wildlife. For millions of years, their only predators were birds, and our only mammals were a couple of bats. But when early settlers introduced animals like rats, possums and stoats, they put our native species at risk.
New Zealand started the world's largest mammal eradication project in 2016. The aim is to remove many non-native predator pests by 2050. Skye Davies is the manager of Tasman Environmental Trust.
I don't think that we love killing animals, but the situation is that our really unique native species simply can't coexist with some of these introduced predators. So if we want to save species that are only found in New Zealand, nowhere else in the world, treasures to us, the unfortunate fact is that we need to kill these predators that are causing their demise.
Back at the pest-free enclosure, General Manager Hudson Dodd believes that killing thousands of pests will help to protect endangered animals.
It must lend a renewed vibrancy and collective life force to the place that's been missing for over a century.
New Zealand has one of the world's worst extinction records. But the Predator-Free 2050 project is seen by some as well-meaning but flawed. Jamie Steer, a senior biodiversity advisor at the Greater Wellington Regional Council, thinks it won't work.
One of my biggest issues with Predator-Free 2050 is that it sets up public expectations that just can't possibly live up to. It creates the impression that the removal of just 5 introduced mammals will be a game-changer for conservation in New Zealand, when it would actually be nothing of the sort. And that's because while it's true that predation from introduced mammals is one of the threats to New Zealand's indigenous biodiversity, it actually pales in comparison to other factors, like habitat loss, like pollution, and even, it must be said, ongoing harvest of native species. Because, believe it or not, New Zealanders are still literally eating endangered wildlife into extinction ourselves, most notably in the case of our native fish species.
Despite these concerns, hundreds of community conservation projects have joined efforts by the government and indigenous groups, as well as science and environmental agencies, in New Zealand's war on predators. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Nelson, New Zealand.
Students in the United States and around the world will be skipping class Friday to protest and raise awareness of climate change issues. The environmental movement began in Europe and has spread across the globe. While their cause is mostly praised, their method is controversial. Should students go on school strikes for political issues? VOA's Marcus Meyer Galen explains.
Students skipping school to protest for climate action. In various countries, mostly European, this has been going on for months. Every Friday, thousands of teenagers leave classrooms in Belgium, Germany, France, Australia and more to demand stricter climate policies. Their dramatic and controversial message, why go to school if there's no future to live for? This is the girl who started it all, then 15-year-old environmental activist Greta Thunberg from Sweden. Last summer, Greta started her school strike for climate, refusing to go to school on Fridays and instead sitting in front of the Swedish parliament. Social media made her famous. When she was invited to speak at the World Economic Forum in Davos last year, she made her message very clear.
I want you to panic. I want you to feel the fear I feel every day. And then I want you to act.
That's not democracy! This is democracy!
Thunberg's hashtags, School Strike for Climate and Fridays for Future, are now leading teenagers to rally on the street instead of in the classroom.
Governments don't do anything.
the world would be a lot worse place because there'll be extreme storms, droughts, flooding, wars over natural resources. So there'll be a loss of stability across the world.
I skipped school today. Well, you can't even really say skipped, because I think climate change is such a big deal that it should be okay to miss 2 hours of class for that.
The movement has picked up endorsements from European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and British Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn, who said it was inspiring to see them making their voices heard. Conservatives have been less supportive. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison voiced his disapproval last November.
Kids should go to school. That's what we're committed to. We don't support the idea of kids not going to school to participate in things that can be dealt with outside of school. And so what we want is more learning in schools and less activism in schools.
British Prime Minister Theresa May also voiced her concern. Greta Thunberg replied, tweeting that May's accusations of wasting valuable lesson time may well be true. But, she added, political leaders have wasted 30 years of inaction, and that is slightly worse.
If the children do something, then Theresa May will notice. People say children can't do anything, but they can do something else.
So far, the majority of school strikes have been in Europe, but more and more countries are joining. The movement is expected to hit the US on March 15th. Many groups have declared an international strike day that will most likely create even more controversy. Markus Meyer-Gehlen for VOA News, Washington.
Legendary rock singer-songwriter Stevie Nicks will be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame later this month. It's the second time for Nicks, who was inducted in 1998 as part of the popular band Fleetwood Mac. This time, she's being recognized as a solo artist and will become the first woman to be inducted twice. Harry Styles, lead singer for the pop band One Direction, who says he's a big fan, will be presenting Nicks with the award. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
This is VOA News. I'm